Continuing in mitzvah reishayin test 279, that a kohen who's tamei should not eat truma. So in order for the kohen to be completely tahor, you not only need immersion in the mikvah, but something called ha'arev shemesh, which means you need to get to the end of the day. And we discussed before that between the tevilah and the end of the day, you are something called a tvul yom, that a immersed by day. And you have certain restrictions that you're not completely tummy like you were before, but you haven't attained the full level of purity that allows you to eat truma and sacrifices, etc. You have to wait until the end of the halachic day, which is at Seisa Kochovin. And we said that the Sefer Achinuch quotes the Rambam in the correct Girsa, which a lot of people didn't have, that Seisa Kochovin is approximately 20 minutes after sunset. So, there are a couple reasons why you can't just take this figure of 20 minutes and run with it. One of them being that we don't know exactly with certainty what the Rambam was referring to by Shkia Sachama, that it could be that it's not exactly what we call sunset, it could be a little later, so therefore, Shkia Tzeisu Gachavim is more than 20 minutes after what we call sunset. And point number two is that the 20 minutes is an approximation. No astronomical phenomena occur by the clock. They always change based on the positioning of the stars and the planets, etc. So therefore, you could approximate this time. We have the technology nowadays to use something to calculate when the sun is a certain number of degrees below the horizon. So if you want to know approximately when Tzeis Kochavim is, so you say, well, maybe it's 20 minutes in Egypt and Eretz Yisrael, where the Rambam was writing. Then you go to Eretz Yisrael, you wait 20 minutes after sunset, or whatever this is referred to here by Shkia Sachama. You say, oh, I say three stars, and these three stars are visible when a certain level of darkness is attained. Mm-hmm. And how can you ascertain the level of darkness? By calculating the number of degrees the sun has set below the horizon. So that's why you look at certain things such as maizmanim.com and other things, other programs, they use the method of degrees to calculate when Tzeis Kochavim is, which is very useful for us, because nowadays we live in a city with a lot of light pollution, and it is harder to see stars. You can see three stars under, you know, if it's not a cloudy day, but you're not going to necessarily see them when they first appear, or the three stars that, for example, we pointed out that even though Me'ikar Hadin, so you need three medium-sized stars for Tzeis Kochavim. But for at least Daraisas, we're machmir to require three small stars. So we're not exactly sure what the medium stars are. There are three small stars. So to avoid all this confusion, we rely on the observations of people who in Eretz Yisrael have, it doesn't really matter where, I guess, but who in Eretz Yisrael have given their best approximation of when three small stars come out, or for Motzei Shabbos, three small stars close together. We said in Eretz Yisrael that occurs approximately 36 minutes from Motzei Shabbos after what we call sunset. It doesn't mean it's what Chazal calls Shkia Sachama, but what we call sunset in the spring and fall, when the distance between sunset and nightfall is the shortest. So correspondingly, it's 36 minutes at these times in Eretz Yisrael, but in America it's a little bit longer. And in places that are farther north, it's much longer than that. So we get to the point where now, our Zman for Motzei Shabbos is about 50 minutes after what we call sunset on Motzei Shabbos, which Rav Moshe also says like that for different reasons. So Rav Moshe's cheshbon, I don't agree with all his reasoning, but his cheshbon was basically correct, Lamaisa, yeah.
Okay, not obviously this whole astronomical discussion could go on, you know, long time.
Yeah.
A couple things about it. So, at the equator, what is where it's the fastest?
Yeah.
Right? What is the minimum?
I think even at the equator, it's something like 15 minutes, 15, 20 minutes, something
right.
like that.
And it's kind of dismaying to hear that you're up north, you know, that in fact, not only obviously does the whole day, you know, get the longer, say, in the summer, but it even takes longer for the sun to set after it. So, you know,
yes.
Yeah. So, I mean, you know, right. So, if you're up in, like, way up in the north, you know, Stockholm or something like that.
It's very late. Even in, you know, where there are major Jewish communities. What's the northernmost major Jewish community now? It's in England. So the...
It was in Russia, of course, obviously, right?
It used to be, yeah. But I'm saying in terms of the world's major prominent Jewish communities, now. So currently, this Motzei Shabbos in London is something like it's after 10:30, I think.
Yeah, Yoni Diyoma, right? So the whole solstice now.
Right. So it's very, very late. So again, you cannot.
But at least it comes.
Right. If you're close to, if you're above the Arctic Circle,
yeah.
You have a problem. Even even lower than that, when it. Right. Even. There are certain times where it does not get the Tzeis HaKochavim according to all Shittas, which is an issue. It's an issue what you should do in such a situation. That's very.
By taking the nearest Jewish community south of them, that they can end or something like that.
I don't know what they decided, but that's very halachically questionable.
All right.
Whether everyone's allowed to do such things.
You can't make Shabbos for 6 months of the year. I mean, if you're in the North.
Well, that's a North Pole, but I'm saying even in a place like, let's take an example, St. Petersburg, Russia. Yeah. In St. Petersburg, Russia, in the summer, it does not. Well, the cheshbon that we use for Motzei Shabbos, and which may strictly speaking be a chumrah because we require the small stars close together. But nevertheless, we accept that. I'm not saying it's a chumrah and you have the option not to do it if you don't want to. I'm just saying that this is the zman that we use for Motzei Shabbos, which is when the sun is 8.5 degrees below the horizon. And in the summer in St. Petersburg, the sun only gets to about 6 degrees below the horizon. So according to some shittas, maybe that's Tzeitzu Kochavim, but to rely on that for Motzei Shabbos is very difficult, but in such a situation, you really have no choice.
Well, wait,
yeah.
Why don't they simply say, okay, listen, really, if us are to live in a place like St. Petersburg, which is, some say, to Japan.
Well, for a long time, the Russian Tsar did say it was for Jews to live in places like St. Petersburg.
Oh, Torah, you know.
Right. Uh-huh. So that, yeah, but in most normative Jewish communities, besides that, even in Vilna, which is very far north, it does get to 8.5 degrees in the sun, even in the summer. In the Jewish communities, say Gateshead, for example, it still gets to 8.5 degrees in the summer. In the Jewish communities are in the south of Alaska.
I know a rabbi who built the old mikvah near the Air Force Base up in Bumshire Rabbi effect.
Oh, really?
In St. Paul, right. So there are Jews who are, up in the west sometimes. So.
Oh, yeah. Well, so anyway, Seder, so how do you, but what if it really doesn't get the Tzeis HaKochavim? So then you have a problem. Some say you wait until Chatzos, midnight. Some say you wait. It's very, very difficult. And if it doesn't get the Tzeis HaKochavim, I agree, Jews should certainly not be living there. So in any event, this so there was a famous rabbi in St. Petersburg, Rav Itzel Petterberger. That was a rarity, and even in Jewish communities where there were, most places that they get till Tzeis Gochavim. Again, there are people who I believe incorrectly hold that Tzeis Gochavim is even later than that, but we're not going to get involved in that right now. Fine. So you have to wait until this time in order to become fully pure to eat the truma based on the stars and not based on any time that anyone tells you that it's a certain amount of time after sunset. I heard, actually, Rabbi Bleich was telling me this week, I had a conversation with him about this, so he was telling me, he remembers that in America, in the olden days, there were many shuls that were confused about this. They used to say, no, Motzei Shabbos is 25, 30 minutes after sunset all year round. That's very, very difficult. It's really, really very, very, very problematic.
Yeah. Decided to say 60 minutes afterwards to make it simpler and not cover it all basically.
Rav Henkin said 60 minutes after sunset. There were the conventional approach that was promulgated by a certain rabbinical group after World War II was to make life easier. They said Motzei Shabbos is 42 minutes after sunset. Why? Because, what?
Yeah, I'm sorry, I heard of that years ago. I mean, 42 minutes.
Why 42 minutes?
Yeah.
Because it's an hour after Lichtbenchen.
Yeah, right.
The day people bench Licht the day before, so they remember that an hour later is Motzei Shabbos.
You always remember Lichtbenchen, right?
Right.
Don't remember what it says, but when, right, okay.
Right. I mean, there are probably more Jews who light Shabbos candles than who keep Shabbos, so more people know what time is Lichtbenchen and what time is Motzei Shabbos. But even that is a bit early in the summer. Again, possibly it's a good according to some shittas, but it's I would recommend. I don't think that's correct to be so short. in the summer. In the spring and fall, so 42 minutes is probably, I think even Arzman gets that low, about 42 minutes. Okay, whatever it is. Fine, but again, you see the dangers of using the fixed number of minutes instead of the degrees method of calculation, which if you're using the fixed minutes, you want to say, okay, well, wait an hour after sunset, so that's going to be good all year round, but in the winter, that's much longer than necessary, so, I mean, not the winter, the spring and fall, it's much longer than necessary, so, again, best to use the degrees, yeah.
Okay, just mentioning government interference in our affairs, there was a big crisis back in the, at the Arab oil embargo.
Yeah.
Richard Nixon, decreed, okay, daylight savings time to be all year round.
Mm-hmm.
So the problem was that the middle of winter, even like a place like New York, you could not daven before you went to work. It was a real problem.
Yes.
Right? I mean, there was no... People were actually showing up to work with their talisman fill on it and, going off into a little room someplace to daven chakras because they, with everything for Zaman, had to rely upon... there were chuvas about people who were, sort of conscripted to go working in the work gang, in Russia or something like that, or some worse, in Germany, during the Holocaust. They were conscripted to go ahead, and they had to show up, when it was definitely still dark, and when they could, what they had to do about it, as I recall.
Mm-hmm.
But it was a real problem. Fortunately, the other people thought they didn't want to go to work in the dark, so that got rescinded.
Okay, good. Yeah. See, Zmanim can are sometimes hard to deal with. Just think now, if we didn't have daylight savings time in the summer, which would have certain advantages for the Jewish community, like Pesach Seder could be started at a more normal time, and Motzei Shabbos wouldn't be at 9:30 in the height of the summer, but you would have problems with the morning Zmanim. That would be hard to make Zman Kriya Shema and Tefila, and it's really a toss-up. Yeah. Umas Shamru Zichronim Levracha. B'mi shehaya ochel truma v'hirgish and izdazdu evarav lahotzi shichvazera. So what should you do? There's a Kohen who has a very delicate dilemma, which is that the Kohen is very happily sitting at his table eating the truma, which has to be eaten with purity, and all of a sudden he feels that he is about to ejaculate. So, and obviously ejaculation causes a man to become tamei. So what should he do? He has a very difficult predicament because on the one hand, he's in the middle of chewing his... hard to imagine this just happening randomly in the middle of the day, but whatever it is. Okay. So the you have a predicament because on the one hand, you are not allowed to spit out the truma because that's destroying the truma. Mm-hmm. The truma has to be eaten. It's holy. On the other hand, you're about to become tamei, and you're not allowed to swallow it. So what is the correct procedure? So the correct procedure is that one is supposed to clamp the urethra shut with one's fingers, perhaps with a hefsek of a mappa, some sort of cloth or something, whatever it is. So you clamp the urethra shut, and you prevent the semen from exiting until you swallowed that bite of truma, which is something that medically they ordinarily tell you not to do, but considering the rarity of such an occurrence, and even if it happens to someone, it's probably going to be once in a lifetime, so it's not going to be the end of the world.
What about something a little bit more reasonable? Than just, for example, all of a sudden you find that you have your hand on a dead sheretz or something like that.
Well, once you're tummy, you really don't have a choice because you're not allowed to swallow the truma. You'd have to spit it out. You really don't have any way about it.
So in other words, sheretz, then...
Because you told me already. Here you know in advance you're about to become tummy in a few seconds.
Okay, you see there's a sheretz up in the ceiling, so it looks like it's, never mind.
So then walk away, obviously.
Okay. That's your thought.
Fine. So that is the correct procedure. Because we have a din that regarding shichva zera, so it's, even if you already feel as if it's about to leave, until the first drop actually leaves your body, you remain tahor, which again is a difference between that and nida, which is that the nida is harder to know if you've actually become tummy, because even after the nida has, even while it's still in the woman's body, if it's left its place, the conventional understanding is that once the nida blood crosses the cervix, then the woman becomes a nida, even if it has not actually exited her body yet. So that's why here you have the option of, even though you know you're about to become tummy, you can prevent yourself from becoming tummy and swallow the truma. Yeah?
So I think maybe we talked about this at some point before. But, okay, is this tumah, right?
Yeah.
Is the basis of like the chassidim say going to the mikveh every day, like that they have had intercourse with their wife or something like that.
Yeah.
You know, that, yeah. And but this is a zera of
Ezra Sofer.
Ezra Sofer. Okay. Mm-hmm. Now, I'm curious, why is it a chassidish thing? You think this would be something which is a...
It's not a chassidish thing per se. It's just that they are the ones who are the most into it. The Rambam writes in a tshuva that he was always makbid not to daven until he had gone to the mikvah after having a seminal emission. And the Rambam was not chassidish. So this was... The question is that that gzera that Ezra Sofer says, he says you're not allowed to daven and you're not allowed to learn after having a seminal emission before going to the mikvah. So there's a machlokas rishon, and the Gemara says that this gzera is not in effect anymore. There's a machlokas rishonim. Some say the Gemara just means that for learning it's not in effect anymore, and you're allowed to learn without having gone to the mikvah after having had a seminal emission. But in fact, the gzera is still in place for davening. That one is required to go to the mikveh before davening. In any event, everybody agrees, even if it's... We normally assume, obviously, that the gzeira is completely canceled. You don't have to go to the mikveh before davening either. But everybody agrees, that, which is unusual, that usually when something's canceled, it's canceled. Like, there is a gzeira is recorded in the Mishnah in Avodah Zarah about shemen. That Chazal goes at one point, just like you're not allowed to drink milk that was milked by a non-Jew without Jewish supervision. So too, weren't allowed to eat olive oil. The olive oil had to be produced under Jewish supervision as well, and that was nullified at a certain point. That's why we don't need anymore to only eat Shemen Yisrael. Be a new. Can you imagine all the Hebrew writing on a bottle of olive oil?
Shemen Yisrael. So far, nobody's picked that up as a chumrah, right?
Oh, that's not true. Some people have picked up as a chumrah. Oh. Some people say, not exactly. I mean, some people say that nowadays, because of the proliferation of olive oil fraud and adulteration, so you really should be makbid on Shemen Yisrael, which is against it's against the din that the gezeira was rescinded. And also, I spoke to someone at the OU, and I asked them about this. So he said, well, first of all, when we give Ashgacha, we try to make sure that the olive oil is not adulterated. That's all. But it said, second of all, even if it is adulterated, there's never been any occurrence of the oil with which the olive oil was adulterated not being kosher.
Right, because non-kosher oil, fats, okay, they would actually cause it to freeze at a much higher temperature. You know, you know this. You know, it has to be something obviously like a neutral vegetable oil, like, you know. Like something like corn oil, where they have it in Italy. But also, of course, this would only work until you found the first case of, you know, Jews adulterating, you know, their olive oil as well, like everybody else in the world. It seems pervasive practice.
That I've never heard. I heard that some of the Jewish brands of olive oil, like the Geffen brand, that they made the kosher of Pesach, etc., that they actually go and have a mashgiach watching the whole time. Shemen Yisrael, mamish! Okay. The Geffen olive oil is Shemen Yisrael! That they have watching the whole time to make sure it's 100% pure olive oil. Okay. Whatever it is. But they call
Pihalacha. Well, this is
it doesn't mean it's the greatest quality, but it is definitely...
Olive, some olives. Okay.
Right.
Like wine, so it's made from grapes, yeah.
Exactly. So, anyway, that's the story with the oil. How do we get to the oil? What does the oil have to do with the mikvah?
Because the question of, like, there was Ezra, which then...
Yeah, it was rescinded. Fine. So the gzera against oil was rescinded. Fine. Yes. So the gzera... Fine. So everybody seems to agree that even if the gzera is officially rescinded, it's still a meritorious practice to go to the mikvah before davening. Again, so for most non-chassidim, there aren't necessarily isn't necessarily a men's mikvah in the community that's open all the time, so it's hard to orchestrate your schedule that you're going to go to the mikvah after having a seminal emission before davening. But chassidim, this idea is given great significance in the Kabbalah, especially the purity aspect of it. So therefore, chassidim have given it much greater significance that they try to be makbid on this. And not only that, some chassidim go every day to the mikveh before davening. Is that what you're going to ask?
Yes, right. Just, we're talking about something which is, you know, relevant at least to this, you know, right? Okay. Yes, so the issue of how can they go on Shabbos? mean, I've met at least one person who's learned with the Hasidic Rav for years, and I told him, oh, yes, please go to the Mikvah Shabbos. No, that's ridiculous. It's impossible.
Well, Meikar Hadin, Medina de Gemara, it's mutter to go to the Mikvah Shabbos, just like a woman goes to the Mikvah Shabbos when necessary. The question really is avoiding squeezing out your hair, or the towel that you're using, whatever, which can be done. The Vilna Gaon was very, maybe because it was anti-chsidim, I don't know, but I started to figure out exactly why. Usually the Vilna Gaon is more strict Dina de Gemara, but the Vilna Gaon was very against going to the Mikvah on Shabbos for men. He says, all the milas that you're going to get with your mikvah attendance, you're going to undo because you're inevitably going to squeeze your hair, you're going to squeeze the towel, you're going to squeeze lots of stuff, which is a problem on Shabbos. So, therefore, you should not go to the mikvah on Shabbos, even if it's required. But it's, I never really understood this, because Mikra Adin, everybody agrees you're allowed to go to the mikvah on Shabbos. And if you're always makbid on Tvilas Ezra, so and it's possible to be nizaran squeezing your hair, especially nowadays. In the old days, all men had long beards. So nowadays, if you have short hair and short beards, you're not going to squeeze it. Even if you put a towel on it gently to dry, it's not going to squeeze out. So some say that squeezing hair is not a problem. We normally assume that's a problem derabanan, whatever it is. But it's not. Even we try to be nizaran it as much as possible, and usually you're going to succeed. So I never quite got that. But the question is, we try not to go to the mikvah on Shabbos unless absolutely necessary. So for a man who's not always makbid on to go to the mikvah before davening, it was not proper to all of a sudden decide to go to the mikvah on Shabbos because you could potentially get into issues. But strictly speaking, if a man is mekayim mitzvah sona on Friday night and wants to go to the mikvah before davening Shabbos morning, so this is permissible. There is another issue with the hot water. Not to wash with hot water on Shabbos, so really you should go into a cold mikvah. Some people say it doesn't apply by a tvila shel mitzvah, only if you're washing yourself in a non-mitzvah way.
But it's not a mitzvah for men.
No, if you're always makbid, so that's a mitzvah. Okay. So I think it's better to go into a cold mikvah, sure, certainly, but the question is none is available. So there are certain heterim for a lukewarm, especially or maybe a mikvah, again, that's too far, a little bit too, even for right now, it's too far afield. But certainly, there might be a problem if chassidim are going to the mikvah every day, because it's been such a common practice that to go to the mikvah after a seminal mission. So, and the communities nowadays are so big. So, if somebody goes to the mikvah, a man goes to the mikvah in the morning, everybody is going to be winking. Oh, he's going to the mikvah today. But so, since that's not right, to have such a breach of tznias, so. Therefore, they go to the mikvah every day, so you should never know if you really have to go to the mikvah that day or not. In addition to whatever inyan there is, alpi kabbalah, that they have of tosefes kedusha, that you make yourself more holy before davening by going to the mikvah, even if you're technically tahor. So that is more questionable, whether that should be done on Shabbos, the mikvah that's really not required at all. So, yeah, chassidim have their heterim, but yeah.
The Lubavitcher is a very mock-patient, you shouldn't touch a single hair in your beard.
Yeah.
And you shouldn't trim your beard.
Yeah.
That sounds very powerful argument to say, if you're going to the mikvah on Shabbos, you don't make it too long.
The Stipler, when he went to the mikvah, he used to make it to go to the mikvah on Shabbos, and he said his brother-in-law, the Chaznish, told him that you should stand around in the mikvah and just shake your head from side to side many times until your beard is dry. Okay. But Meikar Hadin, when required, it is mutter to go to the mikvah on Shabbos. Okay. Umash Amru Berochve Gmalim. People who ride camels. So camel riders are assumed to be a Balkeri unless proven otherwise, because they're riding on the camel, and it since their nether regions are in constant contact and warmth with the camel. So it's assumed that they're going to have some minor, maybe, form of ejaculation. Again, if not ejaculating, but some semen could come out, and that would render you a Baal Keri. There's a different sheetus about that in the Gemara, but whatever it is. So the Roch Megmalim are not allowed to eat truma before going to the mikvah. Even if you the person who was riding a camel had no knowledge of having a seminal emission, you assume that there was some sort of seminal emission. So after the last time, he rode a camel, so he has to go to the mikvah. Umasha Amru, it's also interesting that when there's a Kohen who's a Cheresh or a Shota, a deaf mute, or not totally there and can't be responsible for his own bodily functions, so he's not allowed to sleep after going to the mikvah before eating truma. because he might experience seminal vision, not going to be able to tell you. You know, he's not going to be able to realize. So therefore, here you could put some sort of undergarment on him where it would show up, and you would know. But whatever it is, so that there is a problem as well. That's okay. You guys go.
No. This is actually right. But isn't a deaf dude putter from eating truma?
Putter? No. What do you mean? He's loud.
Okay.
He's loud. A katan is loud to eat truma. There's no as long as you're tahar and you're going.
He doesn't have to eat truma though. I mean, not because you're right.
That's true. But why you know?
It's an easier solution.
You knew chumrah. No, if it's not required to abstain, so you don't. If there's not so much food to go around in the house, and all there is truma, so you might want to eat truma.
In the household of the coin, that's like,
what?
In the household of the coin, right? That was.
It wasn't their exclusive food. They had regular food also sometimes, but the truma was certainly a mainstay. Okay, now this is Nogiatas. Umash amru betruma schutzel arechi muteris lakohen shein tuma. Yotza Allah Migufo. We don't hear about this so much anymore, but the halacha is that the truma of chutzlaretz, what's truma of chutzlaretz? Mostly challah. That's challah, which is a truma that we have to take even in chutzlaretz. So that is allowed to be eaten by a kohen, where the tuma is not. We have this principle by Harabayas also, the zebra category of a tuma, someone who becomes tameh by something exiting the body as opposed to touching something external. So again, Balkeri, Nida, Zav, Zava, Yoledes, these types of things are called Tuma Yotza Olav Migufo. So again, this applies only to the Truma of Chutz La'aretz, which the whole institution is only Derabanan, Truma of Chalas Chutz La'aretz. Even in there are certain times where Truma might be Derabanan even within Eretz Yisrael, but these leniencies do not apply. It's only in Trumas Chutz La'aretz where the institution is completely derabanan that it may be eaten by a kohen who is tamei meis. Again, we have no way of rectifying this nowadays. We don't have the para aduma. So, again, you can't go into the azara, but you're allowed to go into har habayis, which is technically, if you are someone who has tumah hayotzal of migufa. That if you go to the mikvah to purify yourself from an emission type of tumah, then just like you're allowed to go on Harabayas, technically, a Kohen who does this is allowed to eat the Truma. To go in Kohen Shalora, Keri Yuktana Shalor Persanida. So if you want to avoid the requirement to go to the mikvah, so you can give the challah of Chutz La'aretz to a Kohen under the age of 9. So since a Kohen under the age of 9 is assumed not to have ever had a seminal emission, so a mikvah attendance would not have been necessary, so no problem, the Kohen under the age of 9 can eat the truma. Get it the challah, yeah?
I'm sorry, maybe I missed this, but since we assume everybody, okay, is tamei from Trumas Meis.
Right, but Trumas Meis is not a problem for Trumas Chutz La'aretz.
Okay. So,
as long as you're not a tamei from Tuma Yotzel of Migufo, then you're allowed to eat, a Kohen is allowed to eat Trumas Chutz La'aretz.
Okay, got it, okay.
Assuming there's a reasonable Chazaka that this person is in fact a Kohen. But if you don't want to do a Kohen Katan, then there is the option that even a Kohen above, a regular Kohen, adult Kohen, can go to the mikvah and then eat the challah of Chutz La'aretz. Again, this is somewhat unusual nowadays, and people are all nervous about this. It's also hard, yeah, then in this such a situation, so if the Kohen, or male or female, well, for a female it's easier because a woman who goes to the mikvah really is going to the mikvah. But for a man who's going to the mikvah, so A, you need to find a really kosher mikvah. So not all men's mikvahs are kosher to the standard that we would want for someone who needs to go to the mikvah maker adin, like a woman after Nida. So he would have to use a woman's mikvah or an ocean or something that's 100% kosher as a mikvah. And he would have to do a full washing beforehand to make sure there is zero chatzitas on it, which by regular tefillah for davening, according to many shittas, is not necessary. So again, people are nervous about this. So kohanim, the normal minhag that in Chutz La'aretz we just burn the challah and call it a day. But there are certain people in history who have actually done this. They have given the challah to a kohen to eat. The Vilna Gaon used to do this on Erev Pesach when he was mafresh challah from his matzahs. He was mafresh challah from the matzahs, and he would give the challah to a kohen. He says, "No, go to the mikvah, make sure everything's okay. Go to the mikvah and eat the challah. No problem." there's a question if it's sufficient to go just to go to the mikvah or in Chutz Laaretz, or you need Harav Shemesh. You need to wait to the end of the day after going to the mikvah. That is a bit of an unresolved shaila. There are also other kulas that it says that you can, if the challah is already mixed into other food, so you can add other food to it and be mevatel berov. So when the majority of the food is not truma, not challah, then the kohen can eat it even during the time that he's tameh. So we have all these leniences by the by challahs chutz laaretz, which are very interesting.
But yeah. All of the kohanim we have, right, women, chassidus, having to have a mikvah lady and sort of thing, which also apply then for kohanim.
Well, for a man, you don't need a mikvah lady because most men have short hair.
Once his head is under. That's actually the reason, in fact, I got it.
Right, so for men, you certainly don't need a mikvah lady.
Well, not a lady anyway, obviously.
Right.
That would not work.
Could be his wife. that would be acceptable. It's actually funny that, speaking of gender equality, egalitarianism, that all these things that Orthodox Jewish women complain about and could do without, the non-Orthodox women just, or other groups, just want, you know, just love. I had a distant cousin who was the director of the Mayim Chaim mikvah in Boston, the liberal mikvah.
A liberal mikvah,
non-Orthodox. They said non-denominational. We're not Orthodox. Anybody's welcome to use our mikvah for whatever reason. You know, people came after
Reform
Gairus was certainly done there. There are many. So the idea was just not to have a mikvah without the Orthodox control over it, so we can use it for whatever we want. You want to go to the mikvah for a college graduation, something like that, you know, enjoy.
Who was the Rav Machshir?
A conservative rabbi. It was the Rav Machshir. They claim it was a kosher mikvah, but obviously the Orthodox rabbis were not particularly keen on their constituents using this mikvah. And they wouldn't allow, I think, an Orthodox rabbi to come in and inspect it, because they said, Bishita, we're not Orthodox. Any Orthodox woman is allowed to use it. We accept anyone. This conservative rabbi we found to be knowledgeable about the laws of mikvahs, so he's the Rav Machshir of our mikvah. But he's it, and nobody else allowed to come inspect it.
The conservative men all want to use it every day, right?
They didn't want to use it every day. So her husband, relative's husband, I was talking to them once just because I was curious, you know. I mean, I very rarely see them, but I happened to be talking to them many years ago about her work, which I found interesting, obviously. So I said to her husband, are you involved in the mikvah at all? So she says, well, not that much, but, you know, when they need me, I'll go witness immersions. Mm-hmm. Witness immersions? What are you talking about? He says, yeah. When the men go to the mikvah, they say it's not right. You know, they have a mikvah, the women have a mikvah lady. To, you know, it makes their experience complete and more meaningful by having someone witness their immersion. So the men say, no, I want to be equal. I want to be the same. I want someone to witness my immersion. I was laughing at this. Women always complain about the mikvah lady. And they would love to be without a mikvah lady. Now the men, they want a mikvah lady so much, they have to have a man come in and witness the immersion. Yeah?
The men go, say, before Rosh Hashanah.
Or if he wants to go for, again, his graduation or his marriage or whatever. But before the marriage, there are men who wanted to use the mikvah for other reasons.
Conservative men. Wow.
Conservative reform, yeah.
Wow, okay. That.
But they wanted their immersion to be witnessed. It wasn't as official otherwise.
For men, it actually was a
problem. What?
Men is only the Rabbanan, so Orthodox men can use the mikvah because that's...
Right. Again, the question is whether you want to associate yourself with such an institution, but again, there's no halachic problem per se with a man immersing in this mikvah. Again, if it's Erev Yom Kippur, where it's the most chamor tvila of the year by men, that's generally accepted, so why not? You should use a kosher mikvah that's 100% kosher, but if you have nothing better open to you and you want to use this mikvah, again, but besides the issues of associating yourself with them, so yeah, can't hurt.
Very quick aside, though.
Yeah.
For Kaylee.
Yeah.
You have to be absolutely the most as kosher as it is for a for women.
Well, Tefillas Kaylee doesn't encroach on an Isser Karis, So there might be certain chumras that you institute in a women's mikvah that you wouldn't insist upon for a kela mikvah. But technically, yes, you know, on a fundamental level, the standard should be the same, because that's something that's absolutely halachically required, as opposed to a men's mikvah, which, strictly speaking, just for davening purposes, again, this would not be sufficient for eating truma, eating challah purposes, but just for davening purposes, it's sufficient to have a even completely mayim shuvim, just a swimming pool, basically, of drawn water, would be acceptable, which would not be the case for kelim.
So, in other words, the broyer's mikvah, the kelim mikvah, is, we assume, just equal, just smaller than the regular mikvah.
I don't know the details of its construction, but again, there could be certain chumras in the women's mikvah that they don't have in the kelim mikvah.
In general, it should be a kosher.
But al pi ikar adin, it's certainly certainly a kosher.
It's not
mikvah.
Like a men's mikvah where they.
No.
What about Dumbrov's mikvah? How
Dumbrov's mikvah is in between, is my understanding. It's not pure mayim shiuvim, drawn tap water, like would technically would be kosher for men just for davening. They did an in between thing, which again I don't know exactly what you gain by this, which is that on the Raisa level, assuming that Mayim She'uvim, drawn water, is puzzle for a mikvah on a Raisa level, at least when the entire mikvah is composed thereof. So there is a way that you could un-Mayim She'uvimify it, which is by having pouring the water on the ground and having the ground it travel along the ground and then going into the mikvah pool. So my understanding is that the Dumbrav men's mikvah is that. That it's not straight rainwater, it's just water that, you know, moves along the ground. So at least on a deraisa level, it will be a kosher mikvah. Again, what you gain by that, because not deraisa anyway, I'm not exactly sure, but you want to have it on a little bit of a higher level than just pure drawn water. If you have nothing else, so that's better than nothing. But for Erev Yom Kippur, yeah, it's better to use the Boer's mikvah, which is 100% kosher according to the full halachic standards of when tefillah is fully halachically required. Yes. Umasha Amru Shekol Amei Haaretz Bechezkas Tumahein, that ignoramuses are assumed to be Tomei, that they don't know all the details of Tumah and Tahara, and there certainly are a lot of details to know. So, therefore, Valkein Ein Nosnin HaTruma Ela Kvanim Hayaduim L'Shomer B'Tahara. So you're not supposed to give Truma Tahora to an ignoramus, to an Amaretz. You can give Truma to Mea, because they can get other uses out of it, you're not allowed to eat it, so you don't assume that the Kohen, who's an Amaretz, is going to be so not knowledgeable that he would even eat truma that's tamei, but you're not sure that his standards of keeping tahara are up to par. So therefore, you don't give him truma tahara. You give truma tahara only to a kohen who's known to be knowledgeable and learned.
Okay,
yeah.
I have a request.
Bedini atumo zacharti lemala gam keing tosan bichlalu v'prat. So we have mentioned all the details of some of the details of tuma and tahara in general above. You can recall all the way back there to mitzvah 159. Fine. V'noheges b'kohanim b'zchayim u'nekevos. It's applicable to kohanim, male and female. Usually with the mitzvahs that govern kohanim, we're used to it saying, this applies to male kohanim, because those are the ones who worship in the Beis HaMikdash. But here, when it talks about truma, so both male and female kohanim can eat truma. How? When a girl is growing up in her father's house, or when a woman is married to a Kohen even, again, she's not ancestrally a Kohen, but she's married to a Kohen, then she's allowed to eat truma, so this mitzvah applies to male and females, that they have to be tahor when they eat the truma. So this actually makes it easier. So, adrabah, so give, when you're giving the chalas chutzlaretz, so give it to a woman. A female Kohen, because they know exactly when they have a Tumah Yotzel Migufa, when they don't, and when they purify themselves from it. So they go to a real kosher mikvah, and they remove all the chatzitzes from their body, they do a really kosher tefillah. So in a certain sense, and if she's not tahor at the time, so she'll put it in the freezer, and she'll eat it at an appropriate time. Baretz uvizman shehi biyishuva. This applies in Eretz Yisrael in the time that he is that it's settled. He has shame. So nowadays, even in Eretz Yisrael, although it's fast approaching the time where maybe it's deraisa even Eretz Yisrael, the Rambam holds that in a time where most of the Jewish people is not living in Eretz Yisrael, then truma even in Eretz is in Eretz Yisrael is only the Rabbanan. But chutz laaretz, obviously it's only the Rabbanan, so this mitzvah doesn't apply. Again, to the. If a Kohen ate Trumas Chutz La'aretz in a state of having a being Tomei due to an emission, then there would be the rabbinical punishment. But again, there's no such thing on a Derais level as this prohibition, because there's no such thing as Truma outside the land of Israel. If you violate this and you ate Truma on purpose, you're liable to death at the hands of heaven. The ninth parag of Masechet Sanhedrin, Shemanu Sham, right? Fine. So it counted that there are types of people who have Misa Bidei Shemayim, and the Kohen in the state of Tuma, who is in Truma, is one of them. Nowadays, that even in Eretz Yisrael, that the issue is not the Raisa, then this would still be an Isser Derabbanan. Yeah.
We finished this.
Yeah, we have time. I have to. We'll stop soon anyway because of our mitzvah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah. Oh, okay. What's the criterion for saying that somebody, a Kohen or anybody else, is Amaretz? Is it a Bechina? You say, okay, if you can't answer, you failed this test, you're Amaretz.
That's a touchy subject. It has to be general recognition that this person is knowledgeable about the mitzvahs. There were, for Tumah and Tahara in the times of the Beis HaMikdash, there was something called a Chaver. They have an official institution that somebody goes publicly and says, I want to observe all the halachos of Tumah v'Tahara properly. I accept upon myself to do so, and my whole household is going to do so. So that person is called a chaver, so that person is believed regarding Tumah and Tahara. So it says that a Talmud Chacham, somebody who's recognized as a great Torah scholar, not even a great Torah scholar, a decent Torah scholar, is automatically considered to be a chaver. Yeah, this applies to Trumas and Maestris also, a different institution of Neman al Hamaestris, which is that we know there's, again, we'll get to it later, but just Bekitzer now, there's an institution called Demai, that when you buy produce from someone who's not necessarily assumed to know how to separate all the Trumas and Maestris properly, so you have to be mafrish the Trumas and Maestris. And that is called demai. So in order to be able to just go ahead and eat someone else's produce without maestering yourself, so the person has to be a neman al hamaestris. And it was, again, officially accepting publicly that they are going to always maester everything properly and everything is going to be fine. And they have the same idea that a talmid chacham is assumed to be neman al hamaestris. So you have the same thing. That's why nowadays, you have people who are mafmir that they don't rely on other people for hafrashas, trumas, and maestris, because you have this institution of demai. So according to the simple understanding to be melamed zchus on minag Yisrael, which is that you buy with a hechsher, is that the hechsher is a communal board that's appointed by the whole community to be mafrash, trumas, and maestris on their behalf. So then there's not an issue of demai. It's not an individual. It's an appointed it's a body on behalf of the community. But for some say that doesn't work. So are you not allowed the brisker of? He would not eat anything that he or a member of his household under his supervision and authorization would not eat anything that he did not meiser personally. Some briskers have this chumrah. They don't eat anything. So what's the middle ground? There's a middle ground, which is, even though we don't have the reason the brisker of did this is because there's no official institution anymore of Neman al Hamaestris. So everything is demai, according to him. So the middle ground to this is that if somebody is well known to be well versed in halachos and very careful about halachos of Trumas Hamaestris, that person is by default considered a Neman al Hamaestris, including a Talmid Chacham, which is what the Chazon Ish says. We all know that the Chazon Ish's psukim are often a little bit more grounded in reality than her. What did Chazal have in mind? What's the reasoning behind this? Whereas the brisker Rav would say more, no Neman al Hamaestris. That's it. No, we can't believe anyone about Trumas Hamaestris.
Category or this category? Right.
The Chazon Ish said that no, that the minhag nowadays, even if you don't rely on the hechsher, that if you know someone well and the person is a Talmid Chacham or known to be very careful about Trumas and Maisos, you're allowed to eat by them without separating your own Trumas and Maisos. The whole point that Chazal had in mind when they instituted this institution of Demai was that you shouldn't be intermingling of food between Amei Haaretz and people who are more Talmidei Chachamim. So if you follow that general parameter, then you can eat by people who are. There's no point in separating Talmidei Chachamim from each other. That would be so. Someone who's Talmid Chacham is the default Neman al Hamaisus. But again, the minhag of most people is that we rely on the Hechsherim to separate Trumas and Maisus on our behalf.